From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dave Foreman literally wrote the book on environmental sabotage, and the group he co-founded, Earth First, has been both praised and damned for its radical tactics. On today's Fresh Air, Dave Foreman's Confessions of an Eco Warrior. Also, in the wake of the war in the Gulf, Gerd Leipold of Greenpeace proposes a Geneva Convention to protect the environment during war. And Professor Thomas Naff says in the Middle East, everything depends on one natural resource, and it's not oil, it's water. Coming up, Naff explains why water may be an important factor in Israeli-Palestinian relations. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush today unveiled a package of proposals designed to control the rise of violent crime in this country. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
President Bush is pushing a series of proposals already shot down by Congress last year, but with the president's popularity hitting an all-time high, the administration believes the time is right to try again. The core elements of the anti-crime package include the restoration of the federal death penalty, reform of habeas corpus and the exclusionary rule, and increasing penalties for crimes committed with a gun.
No more loopholes, no more rolls of the dice. I urge the Congress to heed the voices of our people, our police, our prosecutors, and help us take back the streets.
The president is urging Congress to act on his proposal within 100 days. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
The Palestine Liberation Organization has reportedly given its approval to tomorrow's meeting between Secretary of State James Baker and Palestinian leaders from the Israeli-occupied territories. Baker made a point today of stressing that his meeting with Palestinians was not a resumption of contacts with the PLO. The U.S. broke off talks with the PLO last year after Palestinian leaders failed to condemn a terrorist attack on Israeli civilians at a seaside resort. President Bush has also said that the PLO leadership lost credibility with its support of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. The State Department has canceled an advisory warning travelers worldwide to be on the alert for possible terrorist activities. From the State Department, George Guetta has more.
The advisory was issued just as President Bush ordered air attacks against Iraqi forces almost 8 weeks ago. The new State Department notice says that despite a general easing of tensions, Americans traveling in parts of the Middle East, South Asia, and Africa must still exercise caution. The State Department also is permitting the return to posts in the Middle East and elsewhere of U.S. government employees who had been ordered home before the war. The overall easing of tensions is reflected in the tourism industry, which is undergoing a strong recovery after a steep decline, particularly in transatlantic business. There have been a number of terrorist incidents since mid-January, but casualties have been minimal, one American dead and three wounded. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
Conditions were still reported to be tense in Belgrade, the capital of Yugoslavia and of its largest republic, Serbia. Two people were killed on Saturday and more than 80 were injured in fighting between anti-government demonstrators and Federal Army troops. Today, there were rival protests staged by groups for and against the Republic's socialist government. The socialists are a renamed version of the former Communist Party. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 16 points to close at 2,939.36. Declines led advances by 3-2. This is NPR. Iraqi opposition leaders began a meeting today in Lebanon to unite against Saddam Hussein and discuss the creation of an Iraqi government in exile. Delegates from 23 opposition factions pledged to work for a democratic federal Iraq. One Kurdish leader told reporters that the federal government plan would preserve the geographic unity of Iraq and give expanded autonomy to the Kurdish people in the north. Louisiana Governor Buddy Romer has become the first governor in modern political history to switch parties. Bill Zeeble with member station WWNO in New Orleans reports.
Buddy Romer officially became a Republican today, ending weeks of speculation that he'd switch parties. When he was a Louisiana congressman, he voted more frequently for the GOP than the Democrats. Up for re-election in the fall, Governor Romer hopes to eliminate competition from other Republican candidates, including former Louisiana Governor Dave Treen. Romer will face former Governor Edwin Edwards, a Democrat, and Republican Representative David Duke, who says he'll run with or without a Republican endorsement. In his official announcement, Romer said the upcoming elections made it a good time to switch parties, but that his values haven't changed. State Senate President Democrat Sammy Nunes doesn't think the switch will improve Romer's rocky relationship with the Louisiana legislature. The governor vetoed a strict anti-abortion bill last summer endorsed by the Congress and has also failed to see his fiscal reform policies adopted by the state legislature. For National Public Radio, I'm Bill Zeeble in New Orleans.
The South African government has imposed curfews on three black townships around Johannesburg in an attempt to stop factional fighting. At least 40 people were reported killed in the township since Saturday in fighting between supporters of the African National Congress and the Zulu Inkatha Freedom Party. The curfews confined more than 2.5 million black residents to their homes. ANC and Inkatha leaders met over the weekend to try to stop the violence. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Earth First is perhaps the most controversial environmental group in America. Their most controversial tactic is monkey wrenching, which is ecological sabotage to protect the wilderness against development. My guest Dave Foreman wrote the monkey wrencher's how-to book, Eco Defense. It gives detailed instructions on how to spike trees, decommission bulldozers, and disrupt construction. In June, Foreman will stand trial on felony charges for conspiring to damage electrical transmission lines leading to one nuclear weapons facility and two nuclear power plants. Foreman maintains he was framed by the FBI. Foreman co-founded Earth First in 1980 after becoming disillusioned with mainstream environmental groups. Now he's written about his development as an environmentalist in the new book Confessions of an Eco-Warrior. Foreman is no longer a member of Earth First. I asked him why he left the radical group that he helped create.
I had been acting as probably the most prominent spokesperson for Earth First for nearly a decade, and I think it was time for a change, for some fresh air, so to speak. I've spent all my life representing organizations, and I was feeling a need to just represent myself for a while. Also, the Earth First movement had evolved, as movements do, and many of the more active people in Earth First were tending in a different direction than I was, and it's important to note that that does not mean my direction was right and theirs was wrong. It was just different.
How is the direction you were heading in different from the direction Earth First was heading in?
Well, my direction has always been that I'm a conservationist, that my interest is biological diversity. I want to spend my time working on issues like reintroduction of the Mexican wolf in Arizona or the timber wolf to the Adirondacks of New York and developing ideas for how to establish ecological preserves. I think some people in Earth First were seeing a need to go more in the direction of a mass movement that was closely aligned with other parts of the social change movement. And I think that's a useful direction, but it's not my direction. And so I thought it was time for me to get out of the way and to be free to work on my issues and let them be free to work on their issues.
Well, you've said that the name of Earth First was muddied by haphazard vandalism. What did you have in mind when you said that?
Well, what I meant by that is that over the last several years, I think a media image has appeared of Earth First that sort of overshadows the substance, the what gets in the way of the why. There have been some actions that I was not particularly comfortable with that just were a different style, more counterculture, more anti-establishment. And I felt that got in the way of my efforts to discuss ideas of conservation biology.
Can you be specific again about the actions that you felt alienated from?
Well, for example, there was a puke-in at a shopping mall during Christmas season in one place. Just that sort of thing. And if other people feel that's effective and want to do it, Well, okay, but I guess, as I'm middle-aged now, a little more concerned about how I get some of my ideas across.
I just want to bring up here that some skeptics are saying that you've left Earth First because of this upcoming trial in June, and that you're trying to change your image before the trial.
Well,
let me get you to react to that.
Sure, and I mean, that's one reason that I put off leaving Earth First for a year. I had pretty well planned to disengage myself from Earth First in 1988, and was doing that at the time of my arrest, and I decided to just put the final leaving of Earth First on hold because so it wouldn't appear that way. But as this trial has drug on and on and on, I have to get on with my life, and the very brave people in Earth First, like the Redwood Summer folks, need to get on with their campaigns and be free to set the style they're comfortable with. And so life has to go on, and I do not know when this trial is finally going to be over, and so I just went ahead and separated myself from Earth First. I tried to do it in a very non-critical, non-contentious way, and unfortunately, some people in the media tried to make it into a bigger split and tried to exacerbate tensions, but that was never my intention at all.
Now, you wrote the manual for environmental sabotage, and you described in detail how to spike trees, how to pour sand in the gas tanks of bulldozers to decommission them, how to sit in trees to prevent them from being cut down, how to cut down power lines, pull out survey stakes. Did you ever feel that your manual or your speeches helped inspire actions that you couldn't stand behind?
I've thought about that. It's important to note that my book, Eco Defense, did not invent those techniques. That sort of thing has been going on for many years. And my intention in editing the book, and I did not write the techniques, they were sent in from a lot of people. I just put them together. I wanted to put them together in some kind of strategic context and to emphasize safety and security, to try to make those kind of techniques effective. And quite honestly, I've agonized over the whole notion of monkey wrenching. I've reconsidered it. I've thought long and hard about it. And my conclusion is that a person has to be very deliberate and very thoughtful before stepping on that path, but that given the state of the biological crisis today and the frequent failure of more mainstream ways of trying to prevent the destruction of the wilderness, that in certain cases, I believe pulling up survey stakes or decommissioning a bulldozer as a last resort is justified. But it's not something to be done lightly. It's not something to do in an arrogant or vicious manner. It has to be done very thoughtfully and, I think, very humbly.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dave Foreman, and he's a co-founder of the radical environmental group Earth First that uses civil disobedience and environmental sabotage to preserve the wilderness. And Foreman left Earth First last year. He's written a memoir called Confessions of an Eco Warrior. You know, in your book, you give the advice to avoid lunatics or ostracize lunatics when they come near your movement. Was that ever a problem for you? Did you ever feel that the group was attracting lunatics and that they were doing damage to your credibility, or, you know, doing things that were out of your control and that didn't really suit the movement?
Yeah, I think that's a common danger for an avant-garde type of group, particularly a group like Earth First that seemed to seize public attention and become, in some ways, the best-known so-called radical group in the country, that it tends to attract people who just have a general beef with society, who are, you know, rebellion for the hell of it, that sort of thing, and you lose some thoughtfulness there. I also think that looking back at the FBI's campaign, the COINTELPRO program against the civil rights movement, the American Indian movement, 20 years ago, that we see the most violent people in the Black Panthers or in AIM turned out to be FBI informants or provocateurs. And my advice that you mentioned is to people who are taking risks, who are being bold, who are showing courage and trying to defend the natural world, and just point out the kind of people to be concerned about that might be law enforcement provocateurs or just might be unstable people who may have violent notions or just may not be very effective in presenting their case and harm the whole movement.
No, I should point out here that Earth First was infiltrated by the FBI and that you are now facing federal charges from being busted by the FBI. Are you suggesting that the FBI agent who infiltrated your group was more radical than other people in the group in what they were trying to incite?
Not in that particular case. The agent who infiltrated Arizona Earth First was a very nice guy and came across as such. He did suggest some illegal acts to certain individuals and try to get them to do that. But with me, when he spoke to me on a couple of occasions, he was a very likable individual. But in other cases, historically, I think we see that sort of thing. And I think there has probably been some of that in Earth First and in other groups. And so what I'm suggesting is that people who have the courage to take bolder measures to defend the Earth need to be smarter. It's not a game we're in. It's not junior high school. As the ecological crisis worsens, as there are more and more conflicts over resources, as tensions rise, things are going to get more and more dangerous. And certainly some people in Earth First have suffered that, like Judy Berry, who conceived the Redwood Summer campaign last year and certainly is one of the most courageous people I know. She was blown up by a pipe bomb in her car and has been permanently injured. She'll never be the same. And we have got to recognize those possibilities.
Dave, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. Dave Foreman is my guest, and he's co-founder of the radical environmental group Earth First that uses civil disobedience and environmental sabotage to preserve the wilderness. Foreman left Earth First last year, and he's written a memoir called Confessions of an Eco Warrior. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Dave Foreman is my guest. He's a founder of Earth First. And by the way, he stands trial in June on federal charges for plotting to damage transmission lines to nuclear facilities. Dave, can I ask you what acts of environmental sabotage you participated in that you feel you can publicly admit to?
Well, most of what I've done has just been civil disobedience. I think like very many hikers, I have pulled up survey stakes when I've seen them in the wilderness. That it's amazing. I've spoken to very distinguished Republican Sierra Clubbers in their 70s who admit to me that they pull up every survey stake they see. So, you know, that is something that I think is very common and very natural to many people. But I think what I'm largely being prosecuted for and have been targeted by the FBI for is because I edited and published the book Eco Defense, and it's an effort on their part to silence me and to send a very clear message that people should behave and not resist the destruction of the wilderness too boldly.
Well, I'd be interested in hearing if you feel you could talk about it, if you ever committed any of the acts that you advocated in your
manual. I'm not supposed to discuss those sorts of
things
until the trial.
That's fine. Earth First has been called by some people misanthropic for putting the environment ahead of people and for putting the environment ahead of safety. Do you think that that's a valid criticism?
Not really. I think it shows a misunderstanding.
Can I interrupt a second and say here that you've said one of the principles of Earth First is placing the Earth first in all decisions, even ahead of human welfare, if necessary.
Well, absolutely. And I think there are an awful lot of people in the world today campaigning for human dignity. I think somebody, though, has to speak for Wolf, has to speak for Redwood Forest, has to campaign for the dignity of other species. We have to recognize that we human beings are one of several million species on the planet. All species are a product of the same evolutionary process, and all have the same right to be here. The ethical point I want to make is that it is wrong for human beings to consider every other creature on this earth to merely be a resource for our use.
Let's go back to 1980 when you co-founded Earth First. What function did you feel this group needed to serve that nobody else was doing?
Well, during the 1970s, I worked for the Wilderness Society as their Southwest regional representative, and in 1978 found myself in Washington, D.C. as their lobbying coordinator. So I spent a great deal of time working within the system, lobbying members of Congress, the Secretary of Interior, that sort of thing. And in the late 70s, many of us were involved in a process the Forest Service called RARE 2, the Roadless Area Review and Evaluation. And I felt that being moderate, being reasonable, playing the game according to the Forest Service's rules was the best approach. We asked that only about half of the 80 million acres of roadless areas on the national forest be permanently protected. And timber industry, off-road vehicle people, the mining industry opposed any protection at all. The results of RARE 2 were that the Forest Service recommended only 15 million acres for protection. And most of that was country above timberline, very scenic, very pretty, very nice to hike in, but not important biologically or for habitat. And it was in a reaction to that I and a number of other people who worked for the Sierra Club or the Wilderness Society or Friends of the Earth decided that there was a need for a different kind of environmental group, one that would consciously step outside the system, that would not compromise, that would publicly state the kinds of things that many environmentalists privately believed, and a group that would introduce nonviolent civil disobedience into the protection of wilderness and wildlife habitat.
When you were younger, I know that you were very politically conservative. You campaigned for Barry Goldwater in 1964. You were the New Mexico chair for Young Americans for Freedom, which is a right-wing group.
Right. It certainly is now.
So I know your environmental politics have changed, but what about the other aspects of your politics? Do you consider yourself to still be on the political right on other issues?
In 1964, what attracted me to Barry Goldwater was his comment that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And I still agree with that. I think many people on the left would agree with that. I would merely extend that statement to extremism in the defense of Earth is no vice. Moderation in the pursuit of biology is no virtue. I really don't see myself as right or left. Back in the 60s, the conservative movement had not yet been taken over by fundamentalist preachers, by George Wallace Dixiecrats, and that sort of thing. There were a number of people in Young Americans for Freedom during the 60s who were very much libertarians and many of those people later went over to groups like SDS as the Wallace, Falwell, Jesse Helms types took over the right wing. And so American politics is a lot more complex than right or left, I think.
In your new book, you warn against true believers.
Right.
But I always figured you were one, as the founder of this group and as someone who kind of preached the gospel, both in your literature and in your talks to people in Earth First.
Right. And I guess over the years, I've noticed some of the consequences of confrontation, some of the consequences of taking a pure stand. And I think there's some real pitfalls there. And for the last 4 years, I've been really reflecting on how can you be an effective advocate for something? How can you take an ethical stand? How can you avoid compromise? How can you be confrontational when you need to be and yet remain a decent person, not lose your humanity? I think that's something very important. I think it's dangerous to think that you have the answer. I certainly have many fewer answers today at 44 than I had 10 years ago. I think we need to respect diversity. I think we need to be tolerant of various approaches. I think we need to avoid creating an us versus them confrontation where we're good and they're evil. I think you get into some very strange psychological states when you really do become a true believer and lose a sense of proportion and the ability to laugh at yourself.
Well, speaking of us versus them, what do you think of the way so many loggers were really alienated by Earth First tactics in the Redwood Forest campaign?
I think it's important to try to understand how you appear. Is your presence, is your style, is it going to be alienating? Is it going to be counterproductive? I think that's something.
Well, let me ask you if you thought it was.
Should consider.
I mean, do you think that Earth First should have handled it differently? Because it started to almost look like a little war between Earth First and the loggers, and here were, you know, people who made their living most of their lives working in
right. But those are yeah. those loggers also punched a 50-year-old woman in the face. They made various death threats to people. They were far more violent and confrontational than any of the Earth Firsters were. I look back 20 years ago when Sierra Club members had to go to hearings on Redwood National Park under police guard because of threats from loggers. If there's violence going on, if there's terrorism going on, it's coming from loggers, miners, off-road vehicle users. It's not coming from Earth Firsters.
Dave Foreman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. I appreciate being on your program.
Dave Foreman's new book is Confessions of an Eco-Warrior. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The environment was a casualty of the Gulf War. Greenpeace is proposing a new Geneva Convention that would create international laws to protect the environment during war. Coming up, we talk with the coordinator of the proposed conference, Gerd Leipold. The war in the Gulf was in part about oil, but a lasting peace may be dependent on water. Tom Naff of the Middle East Water Project tells us why. And book critic John Leonard reviews John Richardson's long-awaited biography of Pablo Picasso. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Secretary of State James Baker says he believes the end of the Gulf War offers new opportunities for peace in the Middle East. Baker arrived in Israel for a two-day visit. He'll meet with Israeli officials and Palestinians. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
At a press conference, Baker said he had sensed the beginning of a change in the attitude of Arab states toward Israel.
I remain cautiously optimistic that maybe we can capitalize on what has been a very significant event in the region.
But he said the U.S. cannot and will not impose a solution to the conflict. Baker said he favored a two-track parallel approach toward talks between Israel and Arab states and Israel and the Palestinians. The Palestinian question is where the biggest differences seem likely to arise. The U.S. favors the idea of territories for peace, meaning an Israeli withdrawal from at least parts of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Israel wants to grant the Palestinians their autonomy, but says it will not withdraw from the territories. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A top Air Force physician reports that eight U.S. Air Force prisoners of war were treated harshly by their Iraqi captors. Brigadier General Robert Poole told reporters at Andrews Air Force Base outside Washington that initial examinations show the former POWs are tired and malnourished. All had lost weight, some as much as 30 pounds. General Poole disclosed that some pilots' injuries were suffered while under duress, but he refused to explain how.
None of them, 0%, fell into captivity and were welcomed by the Chamber of Commerce and thanked for their visit. Okay? They all knew that they were prisoners. They all knew that they were prisoners of people that didn't appreciate them being there. And they were all treated in a fairly severe fashion.
General Poole added that the pilots are anxious to get flying again, and some are becoming impatient with all the tests. In addition to the physical examinations, the eight are also undergoing mental evaluations and intelligence debriefings. Meanwhile, a military physician at Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington says five U.S. Army prisoners of war were not mistreated by Iraqi soldiers. Police in Athens say five bombs rocked the city early Tuesday morning, wrecking tourist buses and damaging buildings, but no one was hurt. No one has claimed responsibility for the attacks. Police say the blasts could be related to the use of tourist buses during a strike by public bus drivers against a government plan to privatize the public transport company. On Wall Street, stocks dropped today. The Dow fell 16 points to close at 2939.36. This is NPR. A cholera epidemic, which began in Peru, has now spread to Colombia. Deputy Health Minister Carlos Alberto says a man contracted the disease from fish, which was imported from Ecuador. He's now recovering. Ecuador has also had cholera victims. Two people there have died, and about 400 people have become ill. In Peru, where the disease started, 258 people have died and 55,000 are infected. An international conference on the disease has concluded that although the disease is mostly under control, many people are at risk, especially those who live near the ocean. The South African government has imposed curfews in Soweto and two other black townships after 40 people died in fighting there since Saturday. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
At least 36 people died after an outbreak of fighting in Alexandra Township near Johannesburg, and clashes also took place in Soweto and Tembisa to the north. The battles seem to be between supporters of the African National Congress and the Inkatha Freedom Party. But leaders of these two groups have been meeting regularly to try and enforce a peace agreement. They met quickly after the latest fighting started, and leaders on both sides have asked the police to keep the two groups at a distance from each other. The police and the army were in Alexandria today. The atmosphere was tense with razor wire around buildings, many armed men visible, and most of the schools closed. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
Chile is marking the first anniversary of its return to civilian rule today. President Patricio Aylwin declared the transition from 16 and a half years of military rule a success. He declared there's still a lot to do in his country, but considers the first stage of the transition has been completed. It was just a week ago that Aylwin released a report that detailed the disappearance and murders of more than 2,000 people during the regime of dictator General Augusto Pinochet. Aylwin led the political campaign against the long rule of Pinochet. This is National Public Radio News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. The war is over, but the oil fires rage out of control in Kuwait, and the oil spill still threatens marine life in the Gulf. The environmental group Greenpeace is calling for a new Geneva Convention that would create international laws to protect the environment in times of war. Their first step is a conference to be held in June in London that will bring together groups that don't usually get together: environmentalists, the military, and experts on international law. We called Gerd Leipold, who is organizing the conference for Greenpeace. The Geneva Conventions already set standards for the treatment of POWs, the use of chemical weapons, and protections for civilians during war. I asked Leipold if the Geneva Conventions already included any environmental protections.
There is some concern for it. There are some protocols, especially of the fourth Geneva Convention, that addresses certain aspects of it. But what is common to all of these previous attempts is that the threshold of application is very high. That means the environmental damage must be very, very high in order that the convention applies. Then there is limitation insofar as it is restricted to explicitly declared war. Armed conflict is not really covered by it. And there is, of course, the big problem that many countries have not ratified these protocols. So what we think is what is needed is a comprehensive approach to it that covers as broad as possible all possible environmental effects, and that then will be signed by as many countries as possible worldwide.
Give me a sense of what you'd like to see in these conventions.
Well, I think, unfortunately, we have learned a lot from the recent Gulf War. We still, every day, can see the pictures of the burning oil wells. Clearly, setting oil wells on fire or bombing an oil well so that they are on fire is something that should be banned. Equally, the spilling of oil into the marine environment or the desert environment. The bombing of nuclear installations can come close to the explosion of a nuclear bomb itself. The bombing of chemical factories can be close or even worse than explosion of a chemical bomb. I think that all needs to be included, and I think one has to seriously think about the effects of nuclear weapons itself and chemical and biological weapons.
Greenpeace has a reputation for being a radical and confrontational environmental group, and I think some people might be thinking that in that respect your group perhaps isn't the best group to try to make peace between the military and environmentalists, and not the best group to bring those two groups together.
Well, I mean, we're not trying to make peace, because obviously there is a big difference of opinion, a big difference of positions in that. We think it's important to approach the whole thing, and our position will very clearly be that we are a very strong lawyer of the environment. We will say what the environment needs, what kind of protection it needs. We will say what modern warfare does to the environment, and will enter into the debate with this position. And I think that can be and will be a very radical position. We do not have the intention of becoming an organization that is mostly concerned with conventions, but we think that this is a worldwide issue, the issue of war and the environment, and we think that it needs, and one way of to address it, and I stress one way, is to work for a Geneva Convention on the environment. However, this will not be our only activity. We will still continue to oppose nuclear weapons as we have done for years now, and we will do it with radical direct actions against the Soviet Union, against the U.S. and the U.K., France and other nuclear powers, as we have done so.
It's paradoxical, isn't it, that during a time of heightened environmental awareness, the environment was held hostage during this war?
Well, yes, of course it is. Maybe we sometimes, because of this heightened environmental awareness, it's more notice has been taken of it. And I think during the Vietnam War, the environment was in a way held hostage as well. And I think you could quote a number of previous wars which did huge damage to the environment. But because the green issues were not so important then, it wasn't noticed so much. The other thing is, of course, that modern weaponry does have an enormous effect. And then what we should not forget that, of course, the more developed industrialized nations are, the more danger is there of side effects of war. Whenever you go after an industrial factory, that has the potential of a huge environmental disaster. And if you compare the industrial infrastructure of, say, the First World War to the industrial infrastructure which we today have in industrialized countries, including the Iraq, then the potential of environmental damage is much higher.
So what's the next step in trying to organize your conference?
Well, we have already, we are co-organizing this conference with the London School of Economics and the University of London, and we have approached a number of international renowned experts. The response is very positive to it. But before we will do that, we are working on a report about the effects of modern warfare on the environment, and we hope to publish this report in the first half of May. And we hope that this report will very much focus the debate on where it should be focused, namely on the environment, and lead away from a more or less fruitless ideological debate of who are the goodies and the baddies.
Have you contacted anyone in the military yet? Do you have any first responses to your proposed convention?
Well, actually, one of the organizers is the Center for Defense Studies at the University of London, which is not the military, but they have links to the military. And I wouldn't, I mean, while I probably disagree with many military people, I know from many talks and many conversations I had with military people that they are concerned about the environment as well. And I would think that the soldiers who have been through this recent war and who experience what the environmental damage will be deeply influenced by it. I think it's very, very, very sad and very, very impressive to see the oil wells on fire. And I think if you see this with your own eyes, you want to put an end to that.
If you organized a convention and the participants agreed to certain principles, what would it take to actually make that international law?
Well, that is when a lot of the tedious work would start. We intend to invite representatives from the UN and experts in the international legal community that knows how you turn something into international law. It would take governments that take up the idea. It would take other experts to come up with drafts. It would then an international conference needed to be called by governments, for governments, who then would have to negotiate the whole convention.
So this is a conference that you hope will eventually result in international laws that would protect the environment.
Yes, clearly. I mean, we couldn't call a conference and at the end of it decide a new body of international law. It is meant as an exchange of youth among academics who will discuss what is the existing body of law, what is needed in terms of the environment, what should be done, and how could it be done. And if you look back at other international conventions like the Law of the Sea, it was a very long process until it finally got on its way. But the first step certainly is of getting the expert community together, hopefully agreeing, yes, that's something worthwhile working for. Then it would need to lobby governments in many countries and say, work on this, take this issue up. And once this has been achieved, that there is both in the expert community and within governments, there's the need for such a convention is recognized, then I think it would go forward and would go its usual way in the international community.
Gerd Leipold of Greenpeace spoke to us from London. Coming up, why water is as important as oil in shaping a Middle East peace. This is Fresh Air. Oil may be plentiful in the Middle East, but water is scarce. The war was fought in part over oil, but a lasting peace may depend on water. Secretary of State James Baker is in the Middle East promoting President Bush's peace plan. Today, Baker arrived in Jerusalem, and he said he would work to bring about peace between Arabs and Israelis. My guest Tom Naff says water is an issue in Israel's claim on the occupied territories. Naff is the director of the Middle East Water Project, a team of international researchers. He's also a professor at the University of Pennsylvania. I asked him why water will be important in creating a lasting Middle East peace.
In some respects, in the Middle East, oil is water, in this regard. In the Middle East, oil is the primary source of energy for virtually all Middle Eastern countries, although there are some that are working very hard to generate hydroelectrical sources of power and energy. But as of now, and for the immediate and foreseeable future, oil is the primary source of energy. So that in a country like Israel, for example, Israel uses an average of about 18% of its total energy supply, of its total national energy supply, to move water, either to pump it up out of the ground and then move it across the surface horizontally or whatever. But that's an enormous percentage. Countries surrounding Israel don't use quite as much because they use less water than Israel does, and for a variety of other reasons. But in the same way that oil is, as a vital resource in the area, is maldistributed, so too is water maldistributed. And that means having to move water over relatively long distances and frequently difficult terrain to get it to where the population centers are. In the final analysis, you can live without oil. You can't sow crops with oil. You can't eat or drink oil, but you've got to have water. So in the final analysis, water is a more important determinant of the future of the region than is oil.
Now, one of the issues that might be addressed in this post-war period is the Arab-Israeli conflict. Water comes into play in that issue.
Water comes into play centrally. Water will determine, in the end, who and under what conditions will control the occupied territories, and by extension, the issue of peace or conflict between Palestinians, Israelis, and other Arabs. Let me explain why. The occupied territories supply Israel with around 35% to 40% of her total water needs annually. The water system, the waters of the occupied territories are now an integral part of Israel's delicate hydrological balance. At present, Israel and Jordan are consuming about 115% of their available water supplies annually. What that means is they're using up their water supplies by 15% to 20% in excess of available of safe yield supplies every year. And what this means is that both are accumulating a deficit in water. That is to say, they are drawing on future stocks of water, stocks that are of water that should be available for future generations, which is a very dangerous policy to undertake. But immediate needs are so critical that they are doing that and have been for some years. What this means is that since Israel and Jordan cannot at present supply enough water for present populations and present economic and socioeconomic and developmental needs, they have got to find some way to get additional water. Now, the only sources of water in the area, aside from the discovery of some new unknown large quantity of water, which is highly unlikely since a lot of exploration has been going on, is the river system in the area, that is to say, the Jordan Basin and associated systems. Now, it becomes vital either for one of those riparians to control that water or that some means be found to apportion the water fairly among everybody. And that translates into potential conflict because at the present rate of population growth on the part of the Palestinians on the one hand and the Israelis on the other, and given the new Soviet Jewish immigration, there just isn't enough water now, nor will there be enough water in the future.
If there already isn't enough water to go around between Israel and the occupied territories, what are the chances that Israel would be interested, forgetting all the political reasons, what are the, you know, with water being such an important part, what would Israel, do you think, give up the occupied territories if there wasn't some kind of larger water resolution that would ensure them access to water?
The key question. Of course they won't. Until and unless the issue of sufficient supplies of water from the occupied territories or some other source of water that it can be easily tapped into and will supply Israel with what she needs, I cannot conceive of the Israelis giving up the occupied territories. The only other source of such water would be the Litani River in Lebanon. And the problem with that is, of course, that the Litani River is entirely a sovereign body of water within Lebanon. Israel has no real claims on it, although I should say that many of the schemes for apportioning water in among the users of the Jordan Basin have taken into account the Litani, and it makes sense to do so, systemically speaking. So it really does come down to the issue of water, finally, although I don't want to minimize the security issue. There are some people for whom there will never be enough security, I understand. But in the end, water is security for people. And until you get that taken care of, you're not going to have peace in the area.
Tom Neff is the director of the Middle East Water Project. He's also a professor of Middle East history at the University of Pennsylvania. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what do you have on Secretary of State James Baker's trip to the Middle East?
We'll have a report from Israel on the Secretary of State, and we're also going to take a look at possible scenarios for solving the problems of the Arabs and the Israelis, what the map might look like after such solutions are applied. We're also going to consider Saddam Hussein and whether a defanged Saddam Hussein is dangerous or not in Iraq. And Searcy County, Arkansas, sent a lot of people to this war. We're going to take a look and see how they're doing in Searcy County.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Since Pablo Picasso died almost 20 years ago, there have been published accounts of his life by his lovers, his wife, and children. Book critic John Leonard has a review of the first volume of a new Picasso biography by the artist's friend, art critic John Richardson.
John Richardson's biography of Picasso has been so much talked about for such a long time in the glitter domes of New York Saloon Society that some of us suspected it would never be published at all, like Harold Brodkey's famous novel, An Imaginary Masterpiece. Now that the first of four projected volumes actually exists, we shall have to apologize as well as exult. Once upon a time, Picasso told André Malraux, "The cat eats the bird. Picasso eats the cat. Painting eats Picasso." Richardson seems to have devoured bird, cat, Picasso, Spain, France, and 20th century art, and Western European culture, and we've only arrived at 1907. We back and forth between the bohemias of Paris and Barcelona. We traffic in poets and sycophants. We pass from circus to seashore, and from mannerist Madonna to ominous clown. And this just gets us through the blue period, with the blind guitar players, and the rose, during which it appears that Picasso was moony on opium. A sacred monster, certainly. A minotaur who behaved as badly to the women in his life as all the other biographies have reported. But the other biographies omit his charm and magnetism. Though Richardson has loftier matters on his mind, like El Greco and Gertrude Stein, we are reminded that the artist must have seemed as much a romantic hero in the bedroom as he did in the various organs of art publicity. The macho rubbish of his Andalusian upbringing accounts for a lot of his abusiveness, and God let him down by allowing his sister Conchita to die of typhus. But some women are attracted to dangerous men, just as some men are attracted to dangerous women, a theme of many novels, most of them French. For Picasso, sex and art were the same thing. Looking, painting, and making love were metaphors for one another. A new mistress meant a new style. He teased and tortured women as he teased and tortured forms, an alchemist and a kind of cannibal. Richardson also makes it clear that Picasso went to so many brothels and prisons and painted what he saw there, not because he was indignant at the social inequality or degradation of women in a corrupt capitalist society, but because he got his kicks from victims. For all his acquaintance with Barcelona and its anarchists, the young Picasso was not the least bit political. Bullfights, tarot, and the occult were more important to him than socialism. He was also shy and hated being short, and whenever he was depressed, he knocked out another self-portrait. It isn't true that he drew like Raphael at the age of 12, nor that his father swore off painting pigeons forever on seeing how superior his son was, though the Oedipal drama was real enough to cause Picasso to drop the patronymic from his signature. Nor was he the Catalan he liked to pretend, though Barcelona was more influential on his art than Paris, and he'd remain more Spanish than he ever became French. El Greco in his hand, Goya in his heart. Le Petit Goya, they called him, this chameleon, modernista, exorcist. Nor does Richardson neglect the Roman Catholicism Spanish style, with its element of sadomasochism. Above all, there was hard work. He was a one-man image factory, as overworked as God, he said. When we say goodbye to Volume 1, that gleam in his eye is cubism. His biographer is already the equal of George Painter on Marcel Proust. He may prove to be as good as Richard Ellman on James Joyce.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed the first volume of John Richardson's A Life of Picasso. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the aftermath of the war in the Gulf. We talk with Joe Stork, editor of the Middle East Report. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.